able to get a schematic for Hewlett Packard. Over to you, Eric.
No, no, I don't need it. I don't need this schematic.
You don't need it, but Andy might get some use out of it when he goes to the next step. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, well, a Hewlett Packard branded TV set is not made by Hewlett Packard. It's made by, they have a couple of different manufacturers. And I can't pronounce the name of them because they're Chinese.
You just came back from Dayton, and I've been told that this is one of the very few Dayton events where Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it did not rain. A real Dayton event without rain. What was it like, Eric? Give us a few words on what, Eric, what Dayton was like, and after that we're going to go over to Wesley, who I know he's got something pretty exciting to tell us. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. It was absolutely wonderful. There was not a stitch of rain. It was supposed to rain on Friday afternoon, and it didn't. It actually did rain a few drops about 9 in the evening, but it was absolutely gorgeous. I wound up with a bit of a sunburn. My friend Matt, W2NDR, we filled up his Mercedes van, big thing. I'm decluttering. I'm getting rid of lots of junk. I sold some of it. I was surprised. Actually, I gave a bunch of stuff to the Dara ATV group, and they were all, like, really, really happy people. Actually, we made some good connections with them in the ATV world, and it was actually quite a lot of fun. We went over to the Dara clubhouse. I took video, some high-def video and pictures of it. They, for $10,000, bought an old AT&T microwave site, complete with power. And they have a really, really, really nice setup. It's a gorgeous place, and they get about 150 people coming to each meeting. They just recently paved the parking lot. It handles like 120 cars. It's quite an operation those folks have.
I just talked to my buddy, here we go. Kent Britton, KB2, K5. All of a sudden, mine's going blank on his call letters. It'll come to me in a minute.
P.
Say that again.
K5, VJP.
VJB. Victor Juliet Bravo, you're absolutely right. And he sold two television transmitters, Eric. Analog television transmitters, 200 watts output. They were driver stages. That cover 400 to 900 and something megacycles. So for people who want to operate 200 watt solid state 432 or 902 megacycle handband, that's who bought it from him. My guess is you saw quite a bit of hardware, and I think you're now telling us what the Dayton amateur television people are like, and I presume this is analog television. I sort of believe that not many hams have gotten into digital television yet, although that may change. Over to you for some comments on that, Eric. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, the Columbus ATV group is the only group in the country at this point that is doing a form of digital television. There's a German ATV group that actually developed an MPEG encoder and a DVB-S encoder. And you can transmit on 1296 DVB-S, which is actually QPSK, it's not ABS-D. You can get a regular satellite receiver, you know, one of these free-to-air receivers, like the one you have, which has an L-band input. It tunes to 1296, and it is DVB-S. It can either be BPSK or QPSK, and they transmit QPSK. And they have an interesting time at it. They have a lot of guys that do it. The German kid, I think, is about $500 for everything. And the analog group, by the way, the Columbus ATV group is linked together. It's actually all the same group. It's linked together with the Dayton group because it's a repeater, an analog repeater in Dayton. That's, 432 and 1296 and 902, and they get some 5-gig stuff. And there's quite a lot of people that are active. And within that group is also a sister group, which is the California group. And their principal guy was there. That's his call. Let's see if I can remember his call. His name is Bill, and he's got ATV repeaters running from one of them from San Diego all the way up to San Francisco, and they're all linked together. And another principal is, you may know, Bill Brown, who is WBADLK, the guy who does all the balloons. Let me think of what Bill's name is. No, it's not Bill. It's Mike Collins. It's WA6SFT.
You had quite a time out there. Make a rough guess. Were there 15,000 people at Dayton this weekend?
As far as the number goes, I don't know. But I will tell you, it was more crowded than it was last year. There were more vendors and there were, you know, more people in the flea market than there were last year. Although some vendors were conspicuously missing, like Ramsey. I don't know what went on with them. But this is now the second year that Dara themselves, the all-volunteer man Dayton, as opposed to in the past where they had somebody else do it for them. So they probably made a really good six-digit chunk of money out of this one.
I did hear that in previous years the actual tickets became a little bit mixed up. People bought spaces ahead of time, and when they showed up, computer failures didn't allow them to identify the people with the valid tickets versus people with invalid tickets or whatever. Has that problem essentially been cured, Paul? Here we go. Eric, I'll eventually get you.
Well, I'm not aware of that. Actually, the one who would know is Bernie. Bernie, KQYO, he volunteers with them. He actually runs the IT staff for the e-testing. They had, on the first day, it was funny, the line was so long. They tested over 150 people, and 120 of them passed. And they had their license, their call sign, the very next day.
In other words, there was an FCC representative who could issue a set of call letters right at the Dayton convention itself. So go ahead.
Yeah, Bernie came up with some software, and the AWRL kind of frowned upon it because they kind of like you to go through them. But basically, the results is fed to Gettysburg as long as they get it in before 8 o'clock, and the call signs are printed out on the list the very next day.
So I think you're saying the new amateur, particularly if he's upgrading, the upgrade can be issued to him right away. But if it's a first-time amateur, I'm having a little trouble believing that he gets...
Leave it, Dick.
Does he get written documentation for a brand new...
Leave it.
Roger. Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about Dayton before we go over to Wesley? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it's the first time I went there and didn't buy any. Well, I bought some 5-watt LEDs and a few other things for some projects they wanted. I mean, I was looking for a lot of surface mount stuff, but that's conspicuously absent from the place. But other than that, there was a lot of good things going on. Too numerous to list, but, you know, it was definitely a really good event.
Sounds to me like you're happy enough to go next year again. Go ahead.
Well, considering I've been gone for the past 20 years, there's no reason for me to stop now.
Okay, you're obviously getting a lot of enjoyment out of it. I can tell. Okay, Wesley has wanted to tell us something new that's happened in his environment. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, actually, I want to play a little game and ask you the question, give kind of puzzle, because you were talking about the way of measuring the properties of the current and the voltage. Well, apart from that, I was able to pick up some basic stuff, and I just can't resist to not tell it. $12,000 device, but that's after that. First, I have a question for you. Which would be the easiest way to measure the voltage, the high voltage, 6,000 volts, 3,000 volts, the voltage that is present in amplifiers, and that method that at the same time would employ the same device, but one would cost $2 and the other one would cost up to $10,000. And you would be able to apply that voltage lowered either to a oscilloscope, or you would be able to measure this on the regular multimeter. Back to you.
There's at least two different ways of doing it, and the first thing I would want to know is the 6,000 volts you want to measure, is that a direct current voltage or an alternating current voltage? Over to you, Wesley.
That would be either one you want to. And you would get one volt if you want to, or 50 volts if you want to. Now, you will probably never make an error. Even if you go with the cheapest $2 way, and I'm going to explain how, but first back to you.
To measure 6,000 volts, if it was AC, in my opinion, would be the easiest, because I could build a capacitor divider network where the junction of the two capacitors goes into an oscilloscope probe, and now calibrating that is not too difficult. In fact, the capacitor that actually touches the 6,000 volts, you'd like it to be a very small capacitor so it doesn't load down the circuit.
How much money?
Oh, no, I could do that with a simple piece of metal plate, knowing the size of the plate and the spacing in inches. I'd know whether or not it's 0.1 picofarad, so to speak, and that going into 1,000 picofarad could give me a huge 10,000-to-1 voltage divide ratio. I'd be measuring 6/10 of a volt of your 6,000 volts with a very simple capacitor probe if it was AC. To do that with DC would be a lot more difficult. In the case of DC, I now would like to be able to sense the electrostatic field that's near that voltage. And I can think of various ways of doing that. Back to you, Wesley.
Okay. That's not the way to do it. The device that might cost $2 and it might cost $10,000 is a voltage divider, and actually consists two resistors. One is in series, voltage incoming and voltage outgoing, and the other one is right after that in parallel to the voltage outgoing. Now, if you just use a simple, you can take it from the the web page, the simple calculator. That simple calculator actually will give you already the voltage that you're gonna get, and will not allow you to make an error at all. That means that you simply calculate that when you put you have a 6,000 volt and you put 10,000 ohms, and as in series, and right after that you put 100 ohm in parallel, you're getting 53 volts, whatever. Now if you put 1,000, then you have 5.3 volts. Simple, inexpensive, but at the same time, the professional voltage dividers could cost as much as $10,000. You can check the prices, and I was amazed. Most of them made by, ESI, they price of few hundred dollars to a few thousand dollars. Back to you.
ESI is not a brand I'm familiar with. A very simple voltage resistor divider network. The series resistor, I'm going to call it R1. The shunt resistor, I'm going to call it R2. The input to output voltage ratio is a fairly well known formula. R2 divided by the sum of R1 plus R2. Multiply that by the input voltage, and that gives you an answer, which is the output voltage. A little bit of care is required when measuring 6,000 volts. First of all, you would like the ratio of the resistors to give you the divide ratio you want. You want to bring the 6,000 volts down to, let's say, 6 volts, so it's easy to measure with your particular voltmeter. Let me drop. So the ratio of the resistors with that formula I gave you, R2 divided by R1 plus R2, to come up with the right ratio, in your case, a 1,000 to 1 would make 6,000 volts go down to 6 volts. That's a possible approach. A second or third criteria you've got to worry about is make sure that your resistors are high enough in resistance that it's not creating a significant load, because your 6,000 volt circuit, if it was something like a Tesla coil, they can't tolerate a great deal of loading without experiencing a change in the voltage. So you run into a little bit of a uncertainty principle if you don't choose high enough resistors.
There's no load on it.
The voltage divider network is a load on the 6,000 volts.
Put 100 ohm on it, the metal one.
The R1 resistor is a definite load to the 6,000 volt supply, and you want to make sure that it's high enough, maybe a million ohms, so that it creates a, if it was a million ohms, it would create a 6 milliampere load, and even that is not insignificant. However, you also have to worry about that first resistor, the R1 resistor, in that voltage divider network. Depending on what kind of a resistor it is made out of, it may not act accurately at 6,000 volts. If that was a simple carbon composition resistor, 1 mega ohm carbon composition resistor, you would never put 6,000 volts across that because it would internally arc over. If you plotted its resistance versus voltage, it would be a nice 1 million ohm slope line at first until you get to, I'm going to pick the number, 1,000 volts. Then it would have an entirely different transfer curve. So that resistor, the first resistor of the resistor divider network, has to be carefully chosen. It might be made out of a whole series of individual resistors in series just to make sure that you've got the right voltage tolerance. Back to you. There's ways you can do this on paper with a schematic diagram that look very simple, but when you do it in reality, if you don't obey certain rules, you could get into a little bit of trouble there, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY, I got a suggestion.
Yeah, what would you do in this case, Mel?
Oh, simple gadget that they, you know, it's been around a long time already. For checking the second anode on color TVs, we have that high voltage probe, you know, with the meter built into it, about a foot long. You know, it's got the finger protector. You know how it's made, with the ground lead coming out of one end of the stick. It's been around a long time. So many companies put out those high voltage probes that are really have very little or no value anymore. You see them sold now for $1. I've seen them at the Hamventions, every place. Most I have a few of them laying around down the basement. It has a 1,000 mega ohm resistor in it and a 50 microamp meter over.
Now tell me about that 1,000 mega ohm resistor. That's the main object that makes that probe 1 foot long. So that 1,000 mega ohm resistor is most of that 1 foot. And if you took it apart and dissected it, what do you believe that 1,000 mega ohm resistor would look like, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
You unscrew the thing, you know, you unscrew the tip, comes out, it's held in there with the, you know, it's a long rod, and it's, the tip has a spring on it, you know, that puts pressure on so it makes contact inside the casing, you know, and down into the casing. You know, it's a cheaply molded thing. It wasn't a very expensive item. And the resistor itself looks like about the diameter of a pencil and about a foot long. And I guess it's, I don't know what it's made of. There's not much you can look at there, Dick. It's just got a contact on each end and then a sleeve over.
That high voltage probe you're discussing, what's the maximum voltage it can measure? In the case of the early color television sets, I think some of them went to 30,000 volts on the anode of the cathode ray tube. Back to you, Mel.
You can get them. I think the full scale on CD had ones that were 30,000, then they had a 30. I think they had the last of them were around 40,000 volt full scale. In fact, they got so cheap the meter was molded into the case. You know, it became a real sort of, I could say, a Chinese bubble pack item that they sell. They were selling in all the electronic supply places, and they were down to like usually about $12 to $15, And in fact, like I say, I'm sure you got one laying around. I'm sure I got a few of them somewhere laying around, Dick. Over.
KC2QIQ.
I'm going to pick up with Glenn in a minute. I own one of these high voltage probes, which I think is intended to go into an oscilloscope. I think it's good for something like 40 or 50,000 volts. And what's unique about it is that it comes in a fancy case with a container of high voltage oil that you're supposed to pour into the probe so that there's no air spaces, so that there's high voltage transformer oil around that voltage divider network in order to keep it operating in a precision manner. Not all of them do that, but that shows you how some of the fancier ones do it. Wondering what kind of high voltage probes you have used, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, unfortunately, Vic, a few times where I've tried to accurately measure high voltage, getting the high enough impedance, like you mentioned before, and keeping the tolerances of the circuit low enough, selecting resistors, it got expensive, but I was able to do it. A couple of times I was doing it to measure automotive ignition systems, up to 20,000 volts or so, and it takes a little bit of practice and a lot of experimentation and very, very much layout sensitive. So the couple of issues that I ran into with trying to get percentages of the resistors low enough so that I wouldn't have a tremendous amount of error, just even the DC error was at a minimum, because the ratio of divider, even at 1% resistors with that kind of divider ratio, you're going to be pretty close to 2% of error. Using 5% resistors, forget about it. So that's where I found the voltage probes really kind of let you down a bit. They're not as accurate as you'd hope they were, and I tested quite a few of them to see what their accuracy was, and I checked them against their data sheets, and sure enough, they're not high-precision devices. Where I think the resistor ratio, you can do it, but there is definitely going to be some loading effect in finding low enough percentage resistors and get the voltage spacing correct. It takes a little bit of research. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Glenn, during your research, did you see evidence of nonlinearity of resistors as you start experiencing high voltages, as you start exposing to the high voltages? In other words, you may have a whole series string of, let's say, 5 megohm resistors, but beyond a certain voltage, depending on what is the method of construction of the resistor, in some cases you get internal arcing effects within the resistor, and it no longer behaves in a linear manner obeying Ohm's law. I wonder if you've seen evidence of that one, Glenn. And that I think you're saying you have, because you've discovered that the physical layout of the voltage divider resistor network could be critical. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, precisely, Dick. Not that I've seen it, but, being an engineer myself, I kind of am already aware of it. So basically the way to get around that is every resistor, pretty much you can get a data sheet on, and you can look at for every resistor, you'll not only have, like, its resistance, its power rating, but you'll also see a voltage curve for the spacing of each case style, so whether it's a quarter watt resistor or a half watt resistor, whatever resistor you're going to use. Start to use to build up your divider. You can look at what the maximum voltage spacing is, and use what I call like the 70% derating rule. So if the maximum spacing from lead to lead they recommend is, let's say, 500 volts for that resistor, you operate it at like 350 volts. So you just, when you're calculating your divider, you make sure you never have anything higher than 350 volts across the lead spacing per resistor. So you can get all that information on the data sheet. So a lot of times if you're looking up a specific case file of a resistor, go to a manufacturer like Rohm or Ohmite or whoever, is going to be your source of resistor, Verchet. They all have, data sheets that will give you all of that information, just derated by about 70%.
I know you're not going to measure it. You're not going to remember this one exactly, but you might remember some ballpark figures that could be very helpful here, Glenn. That is, in the case of an 8-watt, let's assume now that I'm trying to build this thing very inexpensively. I'm trying to keep it under $1 to keep Wesley very happy. And I'm using Allen Bradley or some other brand of carbon composition resistors. and I'm comparing 8 watt, quarter watt, half watt, 1 watt, 2 watt resistors. And these are all in the megohm regions. Is there a rough rule of thumb for what's the maximum voltage I can put across a carbon composition resistor of 8 watt? Is there a maximum I can put across a 1 watt, a 2 watt? I'll be amazed if any of them are rated beyond 500 volts. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm going to offer you some very, very conservative numbers because, you know, I've done gazillions of stress charts in my life. But these numbers are conservative. You can find, if you really look into the data sheets, you can find better. But a quarter watt resistor, I mean, an eighth or tenth watt packages, limit it to 50 volts. Don't go. I mean, even if you're going to calculate the power, I wouldn't go above 50 on the little eighth and tenth watt, especially the surface mount. When you start getting into the through hole eighth and tenth watt, you can probably push them to 100 volts. You go to half watt, you don't get a whole lot more. You're basically still, limited to like 150 to 200 volts. When you start getting into 1 watt packages, now maybe you can start pushing closer to, 500 volts. I think the problem that you're going to see, too, is the materials themselves. They're going to have dielectric issues, very serious, not just the carbon arcing, but just the case around the outside of the resistor is going to give you some issues. So you're going to, I don't think you're going to find too many resistors, even in the 1 and 2 watt package level, where you're going to want to put much more than a kilowatt across them. So it's very important to look at the data sheet. So to build that kind of a divider that Wesley's looking for, not only is he going to need the high resistance values, he's going to need very, very high precision. Try to do better than 1% if you can, and use a lot of them in series and space them all, in a row. And be careful of the material that you're putting, even your vector board. That's why it's good to use a nice long vector board with the through hole parts. To build up that voltage ratio to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
W02Z?
Partially.
I heard W02Z. I got a quick question for you, Glenn, and that is, if I decided to use 10 megohm resistors, whether they 8 watt, quarter watt, half watt, 1 watt, 2 watt, whatever, 10 megohm resistors, I think I've got to be careful not to put my fingerprints on them. Because the oil of my fingers and the salt that's in that oil is itself going to be affecting the accuracy of a 10 megohm resistor. I better be handling those with cloth gloves, rubber gloves, something to make sure I don't put fingerprints on them. Is that approximately true? A little bit similar to a quartz lamp. Never put your fingerprint on a quartz lamp before in the process of installing it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's an extremely good point, Dick. For my application where I was working, I didn't select resistors that were that high. I was limiting myself to resistors that were like 1 meg max. And for exactly those reasons, because, the amount of pollution that would be on the board and, fingerprints and things like that, especially being used in an automotive environment, I couldn't keep it that clean. So I was looking at resistors that really weren't higher than 1 megohm. But yeah, if you went to the really high ones, the pollution on the board, your fingerprint, anything can offset those. Here you're going to be wasting all this time getting a very, very high precision resistor to put it in there, only to find out that your layout and your assembly practice could be offsetting that impedance if the resistor high. So one megohm is very, very conservative. Your fingerprints aren't going to do too much of that, Dick.
I think Ian wanted to give us some words on this. I wonder if you have built voltage divider networks like this one, Ian. W02Z, K2RIW.
Negative there, Dick, but just a suggestion. I'm kind of coming on the tail end because I had to leave monitoring the net. But I have 2 meters, and there's a company that manufactures these meters, and the meters are called Brandenburg, and there's a 139 series and a 149 series. And I'll just give you just some basic specs on the 149 series. At 2 kV, it will give you accuracy down to a tenth of a volt. At 20 kV, it will give you accuracy to 1 volt. And at 60 kV, it will give you an accuracy to 10 volts. And I have two of these, 139, 149 series, and I've tested them, and the accuracy is pretty close.
That's a lie.
At accuracy, Glenn, as you can tell, is a bit skeptical. The Brandenburg voltage meter, 135 series and 139 series, 149 series. Roughly how expensive are these, and what is their intended purpose, if you happen to know, Ian? Go ahead.
The sole purpose is for testing high voltage circuits.
Okay, roughly how expensive, and do you happen to know how much loading they create? Do they act like a 100 megohm load? Go ahead.
Well, according to the input resistance is 100 gig ohm.
Okay, that's 10 to the 11 ohms. Impressive. How expensive? Where did you buy it? And what company were you working for? What were you doing when you were using one of these, Ian? Go ahead.
Not for commercial purposes, but for my own use there, Dick. You'd have to, somebody, if they could go online and look for the costs. I know they're pretty much up there in price, but I actually bought both of them on eBay, I guess from labs or companies that were going out of business that were getting rid of them.
Yeah, but ballpark, if you can give ballpark figure.
I would venture to say if you could buy it brand new now, probably $2,000, $3,000.
How about on eBay? What if Wesley did a lot of shopping around on eBay? How inexpensive on eBay is it possible to buy something like that?
You could probably get it probably for $300-$400 if you're lucky.
Wow, 100 gig ohm. That is an extremely light loading. And if it had anywhere near that accuracy, wow, that's a lot for the money, saving you a lot of effort. Now, I can tell Glenn is quite skeptical about the accuracy of that meter. Is that one of the meters you considered using, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
$1,100, the cheapest one.
But Glenn, you sounded like you were quite skeptical about the accuracy of that meter, and maybe that's why you were afraid to use it. Over to you, Glenn.
That's a meter that I'm familiar with, Dick, and I'm familiar with a lot of other ones that are just like it. And here again, it depends on what your application is. If you can live with, like, you know, plus or minus 10%, you know, voltage variation on 2 kV, if you can live with, you know, plus or minus a couple hundred volts of accuracy, good enough. You know, I mean, depends on what you're really trying to do. If you're really trying to get some accuracy to within 1%, that's not the meter to use. They'll give you the readout accuracy, but if you try to find the actual volt stability accuracy, you'll find that they might not even publish it on those meters because they can't guarantee that the probes and the location and the wiring. It's just, you know, when you really get into these measurements and you try to figure out how to make them and what's really involved in doing it, it's not going to be done with a handheld device. And it's really, you have to do a lot of calibration and really think about this measurement before you take it. But yeah, there are devices out there that will give you relative reference measurements, but the precision is not going to be there, Dick. So, you know, if you're doing, you know, if you're building a high voltage linear power supply and you want to know what your voltage on the power supply to drive your power tubes with or something like that, and you just want to make sure you're in the ballpark, you know, it's a great reference tool. But certainly to get any kind of accuracy, you know, to within, you know, a few percent, it's not going to do it.
Now, Glenn, one of the things I own is an electrostatic voltmeter. It's an old thing, probably built in the 40s or 50s. I think the brand name is Weston, but I'm not sure. Great big, what looks like a Dawson valve movement that is, probably a foot wide Dawson valve movement, what it looks like, mirrored scale. It is an electrostatic repulsion voltmeter. The whole darn machine is about a cubic foot. And it's got a 30,000 volt scale, a 10,000 volt scale, a 5,000 volt scale. The high voltage probe that comes out of the back of the thing is a great big porcelain insulated thing. Looks like it's the main input lead for a pole pig transformer, if you know what I mean. And it's got a rod in there that you pull in and push out, and it's got various clicks on it. And it really is changing the spacing between the electrostatic plates and the meter. What looks like a Dawson valve movement is not. There's really a a great big plate inside of this cubic foot box that experiences the electrostatic repulsion when you put high voltage on it. What's your rough guess of that kind of machine as to what kind of accuracy it's capable of giving? Because it creates zero loading, because it's nothing but a capacitive repulsion, electrostatic repulsion device. No voltage divider is in there at all. You're just changing the spacing between the plates that do the repulsion, that do the deflection of the meter. And as I said, it looks like such a precision thing with these mirrored scales. I'd like to believe it's coming into the small number of percent of accuracy capability when properly calibrated. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, Vic, I'm not going to venture to guess on what the accuracy of it is, because I'm really not familiar with that piece of equipment, but I do know how to measure it and find out what kind of accuracy it would have. I can take known resistors of 0.1%, and I can lay them out across a linear length and space the resistors out with voltage drops across a divider, and I can move it up and down in range and then put a very, very high voltage source across it and then measure the lower voltage very, very accurately across that divider and determine what that voltage is. And then basically parallel that meter to it, if it's a high impedance device, see if there's any changes in the voltage measurement that I'm measuring at the bottom of my divider to see if there's any loading current involved in it. That's a nice piece of information. And of course, the other thing is to take the parallel number, what's on the other meter, and look at the two. But I have to suggest that most of the meters that I've measured that are like these individual probe, digital meter combination type of things, they, even though they're rated at high impedance, 10% is best I've ever seen. I've never seen them better than that. But to really get them down, I think you really have to use some precision, high impedance equipment, and, you know, very, very highly accurate meters, and measure it at lower voltages, and then use highly precision dividers. And then you can get a better idea of what the reference equipment is capable of.
Yeah, I once did a calculation on my Wimshurst machine, and I came to the conclusion it had a 7-in equivalent impedance of roughly 10 to the 11 ohms, which is, again, 100 gigohms. What I was able to do with that machine and also my Van de Graaff generator, which has a lower impedance but it can create some higher voltages, is that I could put this electrostatic voltmeter, this one cubic foot meter, across it, and I would put one probe, the high voltage probe, on the main output globe of the Van de Graaff generator. I had a discharge globe. Each one of these globes is about 10 inches in diameter, a metallic globe, and I had a grounded one a foot away, and I would arc between the two. When I would put the electrostatic voltmeter between the two globes and turn the machine on for a brief period of time, bring it up to 30,000 volts, turn the machine off, and watch the rate of discharge. It would take a couple of minutes to come from 30,000 volts down to, let's say, 20,000 volts. But what was very fascinating is that when it's down at 20,000 volts, and you simply grab the grounded globe at its stand at the bottom and take the 1 foot of separation between the two and bring it out to 2 feet, you would watch the 20,000 volts climb to, let's say, 25,000. In other words, you're looking at the physics experiment, let me drop, that we have all heard about, that if you take the plates of a capacitor with high voltage on them and you physically separate the plates, the voltage on the plates increases. And the physics of what's going on behind that, at first you say, hey, that can't possibly be. Well, it's exactly right. That's what's supposed to happen. When you're watching that kind of discharge slowness, and you're watching the increase in voltage of, let me put a number on, a 1 picofarad capacitor, and I separate the distance and make it a 0.5 picofarad capacitor, and watch 20,000 volts go to 25,000, it's a fascinating chunk of physics to observe. I wonder if you've ever heard of anything like that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and after that I'm going to go over to Wesley. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, actually I have, Dick, and the person that actually described that experiment to me was you. And I, for a while, it took me about a half an hour to scratch my head and really think about it and draw it out and say, yeah, that's what it's supposed to do, all right. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'll give you guys three sentences on what's going on here. When you have a capacitor that has no clearly defined discharge resistor, in other words, it's got no internal leakage resistance, the amount of charge is preserved. The energy also is something you worry about conserving. Charge is Q, energy is QV. Voltage times charge in coulombs is the number of joules of stored energy. When you separate the capacitor plate so that you go from 1 picofarad to 0.5 picofarad, you have to maintain the same amount of charge because you didn't discharge it in any way. So if I had 1 coulomb of charge, after I separate them, I still got 1 coulomb of charge. But the energy in coulombs was being maintained, but the capacitance decreased. And so Q equals CV, the voltage has to go up. Extra energy is created in the process because energy stored is 1/2 CV². Where did the energy come from? I supplied it. The electrostatic attraction between those two plates was continuously there. I did work in the process of separating them. I was going opposite of that electrostatic attraction, the force between the two. The work that I did was by the parametric operation increasing the voltage. So you could say this is the principle of operation behind a Wimhurst machine. It's one of the principles of operation, the influence, so to speak, of separating capacitor plates, getting an increase in voltage, but you're supplying the work that's doing it. It's not a perpetual motion machine, if you know what I mean. So when it comes to high voltage, funny things can happen. Over to you, Wesley, N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, N2XJN. Well, when I said I disagree with you guys, partially, is that it looks like a voltage divider is the best and the most accurate device, and high voltage dividers are fairly inexpensive. So when you have a guy who has the amplifier and the 1 kilowatt amplifier and he wants to measure all of the things that are important for him, he could simply either use one that he can buy or actually do the one. Now, as far as the resistor, well, the fact that the resistor has to be long and you're going to have a kind of Tesla coil problem, I disagree with that. When you have one resistor in series and the other resistor in parallel, and let's say for a 6,000 volt you put 10,000 for the resistor in series ohm and 100 ohm for the second one, for the second one we have only the load that is actually the voltage on it that is actually minimized by the R1. So in other words, is none of this resistor has to be big one. As a matter of fact, I have two probes. One is 30 kilovolts and the other one is 40 kilovolts with a meter in it. Actually, Pomonia makes a very good one. Now, this one is long, probably about 15 inches. Yes, I agree, it's not very much accurate. And also, they have a diode inside, so you can use them only for the DC voltage, not for the AC voltage. And well, when I was looking for the probe for the oscilloscope, I found out that most of these probes, they are only good for measuring DC voltage, not AC one. Okay. Dick, back to you, and then after that, if you let me, we have not much time, I'm going to just tell you what did I purchase.
I'm going to make some comments on what you just said, Wesley. If you are trying to measure 6,000 volts, and you want to do it accurately, and you made a resistor divider network out of a 10,000 ohm resistor and a 100 ohm resistor as a voltage divider network, it would be a 100-to-1 ratio. The 6,000 volts would become 60 volts into your voltmeter.
That's 9.406.
That's the good news. The bad news is a 10,000 ohm resistor across a 6,000 volt source of voltage by Ohm's law, 6,000 divided by 10,000, 6/10 of an amp of loading is occurring on your voltage divider network, changing the 6,000 volts. 6/10 of an amp to me is an extremely heavy loading, unless it happens to be a pole pig transformer connected to Con Edison, if you know what I mean. So many sources of 6,000 volts, where you add a 6/10 of an ampere load on just your voltmeter, many of them will not tolerate that and give you an accurate reading because you're disturbing that power supply itself. So 10,000 ohms is nowhere near high enough, in my opinion, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Dissipation. I squared R. How about the power dissipation?
6/10 of an amp at 6,000 volts is 3,600 watts of dissipation in that resistor also. So 10,000 ohms, you're only shy by about 1,000,000 to 1 as to what value resistor you might want to use. Over to you, Wesley.
You've got a good point. But actually, what you can do is, when you don't put the load from the other side, you just have the two resistors all together and you're trying to measure the voltage. Now, you can manipulate with the resistor that you have. I mean, you can put the resistor in parallel to reach the expected resistance, and if the current that is flowing through is too little, then you actually make the R2, which is the parallel resistor, with the bigger resistance. It's not a big deal. The point that I was trying to make is that this is $2 device that you can make. Or you can spend $50 for high voltage divider by buying that from the eBay. Back to you.
Okay. Well, step by step, we're finding out the pitfalls of, on paper, a resistor divider network done with precision resistors can give you a precision answer. I'm going to give you that. But now when it comes to the details of high voltage measurement, in the real world, you would like it to be a 100 gig ohm resistor for R1, the series resistor, to create very light loading. So got to be a little bit careful. Dissipation, voltage drop, current loading, and so on. The volt ohm milliammeter, everybody who's ever used one knows that it is a 20,000 ohms per volt device. That's a fancy way of saying it's got a 50 microampere meter movement. So if you're on the 3-volt full scale and it's 20,000 ohms per volt, it is a 60,000 ohm load resistor. That voltmeter loads down your circuit. If you're measuring a 3-volt battery and you're measuring it with a 60,000 ohm load resistor, absolutely no problem. If I'm measuring the 3 volts of the automatic gain control voltage of an old-fashioned tube receiver, which has an internal impedance of multiple megohms, and you put a 60,000 ohm resistor across a multi-megohm impedance supply, that's what the negative voltage on a automatic gain control is, you're going to change the voltage something fierce. You may bring it down to half voltage, and the audio coming out of your loudspeaker will double in volume, if you know what I mean. So the one major disadvantage of volt ohm milliammeter is that they tended to produce a fairly heavy load on certain kinds of circuits. I think there was something else you wanted to discuss, Wesley, so over to you. N2XJN, K2LIW in the DECnet.
Can I make a comment about voltmeters?
If you make it brief enough, go ahead.
I remember when I used to work on tube radio, someone showed me a trick. If you took a voltmeter and measured a voltage, or put your voltmeter across the circuit, and the audio got better in your radio, it usually meant you had a leaking capacitor, because some of your BOM would actually load the circuit down and change the operating point of your tube. And an old guy with an old repairman said, if you're measuring voltages from stage to stage, and your voltmeter changes the quality of the radio reception, it usually meant you had a leaky capacitor.
Yeah, those paper-type capacitors that would go from the plate of one audio tube into the grid of the next, as they develop leakage, they would start changing the control grid bias of the second tube, and that would change the audio quality and the amount of current the tube draws and all kinds of things. And putting your voltmeter from that second control grid to ground lowers that voltage, changes the quality of the audio, and lets you know that the capacitor's leakage. Good thing to know. As you can tell, there's a lot of funny tricks that are not in the textbooks about using a volt ohm milliammeter. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. This is N2XJN. Well, today I was lucky enough to buy the best piece of the equipment that I have, and I couldn't believe the price. The device that is roughly estimated for $11,000, and the best price that I found out for this was $7,450, is being called Wayne, W-A-Y-N-E, Kerr, K-E-R-R, Precision Magnetics, LCR Analyzer, PMA-3260. And it happened that on the eBay, the guy claimed that the device is working properly and he takes full responsibility for it, and I can return the unit if it's not working. Now, the price was given very low, and I was able to get it for £385, which comes to $560.41. I couldn't believe that I've got it. And what is it does, let me drop. Well, it could operate in mode, impedance mode, and has a screen on it. Inductance, L, impedance Z, DC resistance, RDC, and capacitance, which is DC. The serial, series of parallel equivalent of circuits, loss term quality factor Q, dissipation factor D, AC resistance, RAC, and the phase angle, also could work in analog scale bar. It has a bar graph in it with nominal absolute percentage mode. And it is able to measure the transformer, ratio transformer, and the turns of the coils. So everything possible. And, well, so many other things. And the ranges is the resistance from 0.0.01 ohm, if I see it properly, to 2 gigaohms. And then I don't have the glasses on me, so. And the coils from 0.1 nanohenry to 1,000 henries. And the capacitance goes from 5 F farad. I have no idea what is FF in English marking, to 1 farad. Back to you.
FF could be femtofarad. A femtofarad is 10 to the minus 15. You know what a picofarad is. It's really what used to be called a microfarad. A picofarad is 10 to the minus 12 farads. A femtofarad is 10 to the minus 15. So 0.005 picofarad is 5 femtofarad. Very, very small. Sounds like quite a machine. Oh, boy. My goodness, what a laboratory is being established in Queens. Okay, we've come up to the magic bewitching hour of midnight in which we normally have to quit. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1297 of this series that began in September of 1982. Hopefully we'll all be healthy and be back next week and discussing our favorite subject, resistors, voltages, antennas, transmitters, loading impedances, all kinds of things, as you can tell, we get into. 73, you all, be kind to each other. Mel, you probably would like to say a few words. And out of curiosity, Mel, roughly how many emails did you get this week? K2KEY, boy, you're a devil for punishment. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, got quite a bit of them on about a vertical antenna. Another one of these, one, the vertical. That we
thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Attitude Radio Club repeater.
Another one that seems to have come on the market that replicating clear same situation as the one we had discussed previously. So I got a lot of emails on that. I also did get quite a number of emails again about the experiments on the Smith chart, guys, what they did with the Smith chart, you know, after, I guess I gave them an insight in how I did it, you know, with the resistor in the line and all. So, quite interesting how many comments I got on that. So, anyhow, I got quite a bit of them and all. All right, well, I guess it's too late to go any further tonight, Dick, so just going to say goodnight, and we'll do it again. But at least about 120 emails. K2RIW in the group, K2KEY.
Only 120 emails. Oh, this was a light week. Very left-handed humor. To me, that's a lot. Wow. Okay. When you used to talk to me about getting 70 emails, I thought that was a lot. Bye-bye, you all. See you guys next week. K2RIW, TechNet Landmark. We're clear for now.
WB2HWW clear. Good night. Have a nice week, Dick. Have a nice week, Mel.
You, Howie, you too.
Good. Good. Good night, Mrs. Schneider, wherever you are.
You guys.
Have a good night, guys. Have a good night, Dick.
Good night.
See you next week.
EB2HWW clear. 73's Mel.
Hey.
Howie.
All right. Speak to you later on. Having a lot of fun with else what we're doing. All right, Mel. I'll be speaking to you.
Howie, okay. Maybe you'll get a chance if you come out to the Limark M-Fest in June. Maybe we'll be able to say hi to you.
Absolutely. I actually do have to buy some stuff. All right. I've been playing around with digital radio. I haven't really been on analog lately. All right. I'll be speaking to you guys, and, yeah, can't wait, June 6th. Got to buy some parts for some stuff that I got to build. All right, WB2HWW. Have a great evening or a great morning in Brooklyn.
Hey, good night to you, Howie, and thank you very much.
Mel, K2KUI, WCDL.
Yes, Andy.
Can you go over to the other repeater, the one we used last time?
My mic repeater?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll meet you there, WHCDL.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.